In Pennsylvania, there are more than 1,100 people serving a sentence for second-degree murder, which up until recently was life without parole. In March of 2026, the state Supreme Court ruled these sentencing guidelines unconstitutional. In this special edition of Kristen's Corner, we speak with the wife of a second-degree murder victim and a district attorney who built his career on giving people second chances, to discuss what this ruling, as well as the political games being played in Harrisburg to fix it, means for Pennsylvania.
Well, we met in law school, and the first time I met him was actually when we were studying for finals. It was the spring semester of our first year, and he was out with his best friend, Joe, and I was out with my friends at the time. And that's how we met, and he was very funny, very kind. And one of the first things I noticed about him were his hands, because they weren't soft. So I knew that he worked, that he was a worker, and I call them like blue collar hands, because they're the little calluses on his hands. But that told me something about him right away, that he worked for whatever it is he had, and that he probably didn't come from a very affluent family.
This is Stella Getchen. In 2010, her husband Todd was killed at a Cumberland County state game land shooting range by Raymond Peek, a Camp Hill prison guard who, after taking Todd Getchen's life, stole his rifle to arm an organization that seeks to overthrow the U.S. government.
So he came from a small town in Pennsylvania. It's called Rocktown. Lycoming County, and he graduated valedictorian of his high school, and then he enlisted in the U.S. Army, served in the 10th Mountain Division, and he used, I guess it was called the GI Bill, to help pay for college, and he also worked in factories to help pay for college. He worked at a Kellogg's factory making Pop-Tarts. And then when he later went on to law school, in the summers, he would make extra money working at the Carlisle Tire Factory. And that was really hard work, from what I understand. I mean, the conditions there were, it was hot. And especially in the summertime, it was even more hot. So he worked really hard for everything he had. And, despite coming from very little in terms of, any kind of financial background, he became a success through hard work. And again, Todd was one who, he was law-abiding, he played by the rules, he worked hard, and all of those contributed to his success in life.
So you met during finals?
Yeah.
Kind of by accident.
Yeah.
Then I assume that you dated.
We did. I think we had come back from Kmart at the time. And he somehow got a little ring from like those gumball machines. And, because back then we really didn't have any money. I mean, we took out loans to go to law school, and again, this was before we had any real jobs, so we didn't have a lot of money. And he got this ring that he got from like the gumball machine, and that's the ring that he used to propose to me. And now, in retrospect, I'm thinking, gosh, that was that was an interesting proposal on the way home from Kmart. But surprisingly, I said yes, especially since that wasn't maybe a proposal that most girls like dream about, but it was our thing. We were both very practical people, and I actually did tell, we had kind of a conversation about like proposals and engagements, and I had told him flat out, you know, don't get me an expensive ring that I'm not going to use, because I wasn't really into jewelry. I wasn't that type of person. But so instead of the engagement ring, he knew I needed a car, so he bought his mom's car for me. That was his engagement, you know, gift to me instead of a ring. So it was a very practical, you know, it was a very practical gift, but one that I really needed.
And you were married. And what was that like?
You know, nothing exciting. You know, it's a lot of the day-to-day stuff, you know, that marriage is. You know, and one thing that we never argued about money. And I don't know if it's because in the beginning we really didn't have a lot, but that was one thing that we just never argued about. We were always on the same page with financial matters. We're both very conservative that way. And, you know, shortly thereafter, after we were married, we had Ethan, we had our baby. And I remember coming home from the hospital, and both of us, you know, I was in the back seat with Ethan while Todd was driving. And I remember saying, oh my gosh, you know, they're like, they just sent us home with this baby. Like, you know, they're assuming that we know what to do with a baby. And, you know, so we're both kind of freaking out on our ride home. But, you know, I said, look, there's millions of people in this world, right, that have children. And surely we're capable of raising a human being. But we took our role very seriously. And Todd was a very, very active father. He had an active role in raising Ethan. And even though he only spent 6 years with him, they were an impactful 6 years, because to this day, there are some things that Ethan says, and I say, well, who told you that? He goes, well, Dad did. And I'm like, Dad told you that? I mean, imagine all of the things you'd have to cram into 6 years, and Ethan still remembers a lot of them. And it amazes me, it really does.
He had hobbies as well.
He did. So he was an avid hunter, and he also liked to go to the rifle range to do target shooting. That was something that he enjoyed. He also did a lot of things around the house, and that's how he spent a lot of time with Ethan, is, you know, just doing, they would always spend so much time outside in the backyard, and, you know, they would do things that sometimes, like most moms, would kind of cringe about, which is, you know, like digging holes and doing stuff like that, that, like, you know, boys and men like to do. And but I, you know, they seemed to have fun doing it, so, you know, I was okay with that. But, you know, that he really encouraged Ethan's curiosity about everything. So Ethan, as a young boy, was very curious about things like electricity, you know, how things worked. And what's funny, a funny story about him is, when he was in daycare, and they had like a time that they were watching a movie, and back then, you know, they had these CD players where, you know, you put the CD, I don't know if they do that anymore, but they would put the CD in this player, and, you know, they would show the children these movies. Well, when I would pick them up, they said, well, Ethan wasn't really interested in watching the movie so much as he would walk behind the equipment and look at how everything worked. You know, that he would look at like how the machines worked, and he was really interested in all the wires and stuff that were connecting the machine. So he was, at a very early age, very interested in that. And his dad really encouraged that, you know, and he would do things like he would get like an outlet and put it in a box so that Ethan could safely like plug and unplug things without, you know, any electricity being involved. So those are the sorts of things that they did together. And they would always go to Home Depot together. And, you know, for most kids, they wanted to go to like a toy store like Toys R Us. Ethan asked to go to Home Depot. That was his store. And, you know, that was something that he and his dad shared. But then I think of, you know, all the years after that, that he was deprived of all of those, you know, the advice and, you know, just little nuggets of information that a parent shares.
Yeah. It's those small moments.
Yes.
That means so much.
Yes.
So on July 21st of 2010, Todd went to a state game land shooting range.
Yes.
Tell me about that day.
So I went to work. I was supposed to have a dinner with, we had guests from our corporate office that came to visit us, and I was supposed to go to dinner with these with our corporate guests, and I really didn't want to do that night. And so I had, you know, I went to my boss and I said, "Do you really need me at this dinner? I'd prefer to just go home." And he said it wasn't mandatory. So, you know, I then reached out to Todd and I called him. No answer. Called him again. And it was odd that he wouldn't even pick up. It went straight to voicemail. And so I just thought, well, that's, you know, that's weird. And and I was leaving voicemail messages like, "Look, you know, I don't have to go to this dinner. I can come home and have dinner with you and Ethan. Just let me know what you guys are doing." Still nothing. So I drove home, pulled into the driveway. And as I'm opening the door, in my side mirror, I see two detectives. Well, again, I'm assuming they were detectives, but at the time I was like, why are these two men in like kind of suits walking up my driveway? And then I'm trying to process all this information, and I see the badges on their belt loop. And I'm thinking, okay, this is strange. So I get up, I'm standing right outside my car, and they asked me, "Are you Todd Getchen's wife?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Okay, well, we're gonna have to have you sit down." And, you know, being a little bit stubborn, I said, "No, I need for you to tell me what's going on." And they said, "No, you really, you need to sit down." And I said, "No, you need to tell me what's going on." So after this, a little bit of this back and forth, they finally just said, "Todd died today." And I was trying to take that in because, you know, that's not something you expect to hear when you're coming home from work expecting to have dinner with, you know, your husband and your son. So I was trying to process that, and in the time that I was trying to figure out what was going on, my thought went immediately to Ethan, because I knew that he should have picked up Ethan by now, because it was like 6 o'clock, and you know, it was summertime, so he was at the YMCA in Camp Hill, summer camp. And so I was thinking, well, where's my son? And they both looked at each other, and they said, "What do you mean?" I said, "He was, you know, he was supposed to pick him up from camp." And they're like, "Well, then he's probably still there." So I'm trying to think, well, wait a minute, if Todd died, because I didn't know how he died, they hadn't given me any information. So I'm thinking now, oh my gosh, is Ethan with him? Did something happen to him? But they just kept saying, "No, he's, you know, he's probably still at camp." And they're like, "Okay, we'll pick him up." And I said, "No, you will not pick up my son." I said, he doesn't know who you are. I said, that's, I'm not gonna do that to him. So I called a good friend, and the only thing I said was, "I need for you to pick up Ethan." She didn't ask why. She didn't ask what's going on. She must have sensed or heard it in my voice that there's something had happened and that all she needed to do was go pick up Ethan. And I said, "And you can't bring him home." because the police told me that it wasn't, for some reason, maybe it wasn't safe in the house. So I said, you need to bring him to your house. And she just said, yes, I'm leaving right now. That's it. And she was an angel. Thank goodness for her, because I don't think I could have explained everything, because at that point, really, all I knew was Todd had died. I didn't know what had happened. And later that night, we didn't stay at the house because, again, we didn't know if it was safe. And still at that point, I really didn't know what had happened. They weren't giving me a lot of information. So we went to a friend's house, and I told the other friend to meet us there with Ethan. And that was the night that I had to tell Ethan that his dad wasn't coming home. And I tell you, that was probably, not probably, that was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
I can't imagine.
It was hard. And he was inconsolable for a really long time. And when I finally got him calmed down, I told him, I said, you know, your dad will always be with you. And he said something remarkable for a six-year-old. He said, Mom, I know, because his blood runs through mine. A six-year-old saying that.
At what point did you learn what had happened to Todd?
Not until the investigation had been underway, and it was after an autopsy. They told me what had happened, and that he had been shot in the back multiple times. And I sat there and I just thought, what kind of a coward would shoot someone in the back? I mean, of course, if he had shot him, you know, facing him, that would be just as awful. But there's a level of cowardice and evil and cruelty shooting someone in the back that way. So, you know, what's interesting is the night, and that was after the autopsy was done, the first night, after I had found out that Todd had died and after I had put Ethan to bed, I remember, I couldn't sleep. And as I stayed awake that night, I thought, I wonder what this man is doing. I wonder if he's sleeping. And I imagined what it would be like for someone to have taken another person's life. And are they going about their life as though nothing happened? Are they sleeping? And those were the kinds of thoughts that were occurring to me, trying to figure out, you know, the kind of person that would do something like that.
So eventually, that individual was identified.
Yes.
Apprehended. And charged with first-degree felony murder.
Yes. There was a pretty extensive investigation. I remember, some of the detectives coming to me, and I believe at the time they were Pennsylvania State Police, and they had asked me if Todd had ever mentioned meeting anyone unusual at the gun range. And I don't know if I should talk about this or not, but it's already been adjudicated. But so I had said, well, he did mention one guy, but he didn't. It was just a little conversation. We didn't really dwell on it. But because of the way he was describing him, You know, I think he was like a veteran, like maybe he was in the military in some capacity, and an older guy. And then they asked for more information, and I said, well, I don't really want to give any more information than that, because that's the only thing I remember. And if I like try to think of more things, you know, I'm afraid that I'm just going to be misremembering. So I said that that's really the only, you know, guidance that I have. It's the only thing I remember. And interestingly enough, it turns out that the person who did this, he was a prison guard in Camp Hill, a veteran, and he was 64 years old at the time he committed this heinous act, 64 years old. And the reason why that's so striking to me is this is not some youthful indiscretion. This isn't something that, you know, he was young and didn't know any better. He was 64 years old, and he was employed. So it's not as though, you know, he didn't have a job and he wanted something and he didn't have any other capability of getting it. That wasn't this case. He was 64 years old, and we had entrusted him with guarding prisoners. So it was just, it was very unusual. And you know, he never took responsibility for what he did. He never took accountability, nothing. He didn't apologize, you know. It's like his life didn't, you know, didn't really change the way ours changed.
So he was charged with felony murder one.
Yes.
And then pled to second degree murder.
Correct.
Instead.
Yes.
So, in your mind, he has been convicted and he is going to be incarcerated based on the sentencing.
Yes.
For the rest of his life.
That was my understanding. And that's another thing, is at the time when he had pleaded no contest, again, his way of, I guess, admitting that the state had enough evidence, but he didn't actually, you know, own up to what he did. And in return, it was a second degree murder conviction instead of first degree. There was no trial. So, you know, he was spared that. But he, I think he went through three appeals. And, you know, my attorney friends all said, Stella, it's done. It's final. He's exhausted all appeals. He's in there for life with no chance of parole. You know, you don't have to worry about this anymore.
At the time, both first and second degree murder carried the same sentence. Life in prison without the possibility of parole. However, first degree murder also carried a possible death sentence. Like so many other families in Pennsylvania who lost a family member to murder, the courts agreed to a plea deal for Raymond Peake. He pled no contest to second degree murder, which took away the possibility of receiving the death sentence, and in turn, saved the Getchen family from the trauma of having to go through a trial. To learn more about second degree murder, I sat down with York County District Attorney Tim Barker. Tim Barker became York County's District Attorney on January 17th of 2025. His emphasis has been and continues to be public safety, community well-being, and fairness in his role as York County's top law enforcement official. He has served the York County community since 1998 as a prosecutor. Tim is known nationally for his work in complex trials, including homicide, child abuse, elder abuse, domestic violence, and vehicular crimes. And he has earned multiple national recognitions for the work that he has done on behalf of all York Countyans. Tim, if I could begin, What is second-degree murder?
So second-degree murder in Pennsylvania is what's commonly called felony murder. We've carved that out as being separate from first-degree murder, which is the specific intent to kill with malice, a premeditated and intentional killing. Second-degree murder, felony murder, is essentially the causing of a death during the perpetration of certain specific enumerated felonies. And what happens is those very serious felonies like robbery, rape, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, crimes like that that are at the very highest of our felony of the first degree type crimes of violence, that the malice that you need to commit murder is taken from the intentional perpetration of the underlying serious felony. So if someone dies in the course of that, then you can be convicted of second-degree murder based upon the intentional committing of that underlying very serious felony.
So recently, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court issued a ruling on second-degree murder and the sentencing standards in second-degree murder in the Lee decision. What does that ruling mean?
So it's a very interesting decision because of how they came about with approaching this issue. In a nutshell, they found that the sentencing scheme for murder of the second degree, which has only one type of sentence for all offenders, which is mandatory life without parole, that was facially unconstitutional. The United States Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. Pennsylvania's Constitution prohibits cruel punishment. And what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court found is that while this may not constitute cruel and unusual punishment under the United States Constitution, under the Eighth Amendment, it does constitute cruel punishment under the Pennsylvania Constitution. And so based upon that, they determined that the challenge was not just solely to this defendant, Mr. Lee, that this was really, it was challenging the face of the statute, which is, hey, everybody, regardless of their degree of culpability, is facing life without parole for committing this. That is constitutionally cruel, and so therefore, that has to be found to be unconstitutional. Now, the impact of that is, because his specific claim, and I know we'll get into this in a couple moments with what remedies to do, but I want to say up front, his specific challenge to why it was facially unconstitutional dealt with him saying, when you did not intend to kill someone, and were not the actual killer. And that becomes an important distinguishing factor, trying to distinguish the degree of culpability. He's saying, I wasn't those things, yet on its face, I have to get life without parole. And they said, without taking into account the degree of culpability, it's unconstitutional, and so there needs to be a new mechanism.
Well, it is called second degree murder, and hundreds of inmates serving life sentences could get a second chance after the Supreme Court ruled mandatory life is unconstitutional.
Today's ruling stems from a break-in at a home in Pittsburgh in which somebody was shot and killed. One of the people convicted is not the one who pulled the trigger, so he was convicted of second-degree murder. Until today, that came with a mandatory life sentence with no possibility of parole.
So I found out, I had the TV on the weekend, and I was at my kitchen table, either paying a bill or doing something else there. So my attention wasn't really focused on the TV. But the show that was on was, I think it's called This Week in Pennsylvania. It's on ABC 27 News. I'm kind of looking down, paying a bill, and I hear, okay, so the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the second degree murder murder sentences, life without parole, automatic life without parole is unconstitutional. And that kind of perked my ears. I just looked up at the TV and I was like, did I just hear that? Because I knew, you know, what what Todd's murderer had been sentenced with. So when I heard that, they didn't, because the show was wrapping up, they didn't really talk much more about it. But I was like, I couldn't have heard that correctly. So I Googled it. And sure enough, that's what had happened. And I'm thinking, I started panicking because I thought, you know, oh my gosh, this person's gonna be let out. I lived the trauma all over again from something that I thought was final, was done, was put aside. And it was really, really difficult. I mean, I couldn't work, you know, and I pride myself in being a hard worker and, you know, putting everything I have into work. I couldn't work. I was so distraught, and I had to finally admit that I couldn't work anymore. So I took leave, and you know, still trying to contact as many people as possible. And then I just felt like no one was listening.
In their ruling, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court handed down a mandate to the legislature to create new sentencing guidelines, which allow for flexibility in cases where the defendant had reduced culpability within 120 days. Following this mandate, the Pennsylvania Senate immediately started working with victim advocates, prosecutors, and law enforcement to create bipartisan legislation which had a 35-year mandatory minimum floor, a life without the possibility of parole ceiling, and most importantly, allowed for lesser sentences for those with reduced culpability. The Senate passed this legislation not once, but twice, with broad bipartisan support, giving the House nearly a month and a half to respond. Unfortunately, the House waited until the day before the deadline to vote on this issue. Instead of passing the Senate solution and sending it to the governor's desk to bring a close to this issue, the House gutted the bill, passed it largely along party lines, and sent it back to the Senate before going on summer recess. In their amendments, House Democrats removed the 35-year mandatory minimum without supplement, meaning there would no longer be a minimum sentence for second-degree murder, and lenient judges would be able to give convicted murderers community service if they see fit. House Democrats also added broad medical release provisions with expansive illness categories, which have little to do with actual end-of-life conditions, which may be diagnosed by non-physicians or physicians who are not even treating the incarcerated individual. This means that individuals convicted of second-degree murder may be released from prison if a social worker declares that they have a condition such as diabetes, asthma, or acid reflux. Amendments by House Democrats also restricted the time victims had to respond to petitions for resentencing to 7 days. Only 7 days, and only allowed victims who are already registered to participate.
In looking at all the issues of crime bills that we've had through the years, and how we always kept our focus on the mission. And when I think about the people we work with, our partners are across all political parties in York County. We come together, we work together, some of our strongest partners. It is not a question of Republican here, Democrat here, independent here, other part. It's all together understanding that this is a 100% community issue. They come together and we're all there working together, thinking together. And there's no room for brazen partisanship and for this kind of thing that we just saw here. And the Senate bill, like I said, I read it. Anybody can go ahead and say, as I looked at it and what it was going to be, anybody can go ahead and say, well, maybe this clause here, that. It's a compromise, excellent compromise piece of legislation that accomplished the goals that were supposed to be done.
Passed in a bipartisan manner.
Yes.
Not once,
but twice.
Yes.
And you are spot on. It isn't everything that everyone wanted, but it was crafted thoughtfully with district attorneys at the table, law enforcement, victim advocates, all of the parties at the table to come up with that solution. Mm. You know, when we talk about victims, one of the things that concerned me was a change that was made in the House to the timelines that were given to victims' families to respond to those petitions for parole and resentencing. Thank you for proactively having your victim advocates reaching out to those individuals that are going to be directly impacted by this. I've spoken to victims who said, I didn't know until I saw it on television. I can't imagine what that feels like. But it sparked a question, which is it common for victims' families not to register with the Office of Victim Advocate in a second-degree murder case, and why?
So depending upon the age of the case, absolutely, because a lot of the registration aspects, there's a lot of individuals who are convicted prior to having all of the opportunities for that type of communication. So you start off with that, and then once it became available, well, their loved one was killed by somebody doing life without parole. And for a lot of victims, when they know that it was life without parole, and especially the cases where they pled guilty, there was a certainty that came out of it. One of the reasons why we would offer that for somebody who committed murder of the first degree, but we're offering you a plea to murder of the second degree for that life without parole, is the certainty.
So that's when I called Joe, who is, you know, he was Todd's best friend in law school. And anytime there's something that I can't fix myself, because I'm a proud person. I want to try to do as much as I can for myself. You know, that's just my character. But when I can't, I've always turned to Joe. And so I texted him and I said, I need to talk to you right away. And he called me as soon as he could. And I told him what was going on. I said, I'm panicked. You know, I think there's a possibility that the person who killed Todd is getting out of prison. And I said, I have done all I could, and it feels like no one's listening. And he said, I said, do you know someone you can reach out to? And he said, yes. And he contacted you, and you were the first person who reached out to me. And I really appreciate that. I appreciate you. I appreciate the compassion that you've shown me. And I can't thank you enough for, you know, giving me an opportunity to tell my story so that people know that there's a human face to the things that the legislature does. And real people are impacted by the decisions made in this building. And sometimes I think that's lost. I think sometimes that's lost on legislators. If they decide that they're for the murderers and they want to show some compassion to them, have them explain it. And I don't think they can, because my own representative, Nate Davidson, he refuses to acknowledge my email, my hand-delivered letter, because I didn't want them to say, oh, we didn't get the email. I hand-delivered a letter to his office. My friends have emailed him and said, you know, they support what I want. And, you know, he said, he immediately responded to them and said that he would respond to me directly. It's been 2 weeks. I still haven't heard from Mr. Davidson, and he's running for re-election. I'm assuming that the reason why he hasn't responded to me is because he can't explain his vote. He voted yes on House Bill 1042. And I want him to explain to me, his constituent, why he thought that was a good idea. And he hasn't. And the only thing I can think of is that he's either ashamed of his vote, he can't explain it. And I understand the Senate bill, because you needed to try to get the Democrats to try to, you know, vote for your bill so that you could get something passed. And I get that. But, you know, I don't want a compromised, watered-down bill that would let the person who killed my husband out of prison. And I think this is important enough to not compromise on. You know, I do understand that there has to be some compromise, but it has to make sense. And, you know, if there are legislators who don't want to vote for something because they're for the murderers and they're for compassionate release of people who've killed other people, I want them to talk to me. I want them to look at me and to talk to me face to face. And we'll have a debate about it.
Jella, I don't know how anyone cannot have compassion for what you have experienced. And I know just from loss within my own family that was not anywhere near as tragic or unexpected as what you went through. You find a way to live, but you never get over it.
That's very well said, yes.
And so we are here as legislators. Our job is to be the voice of the people, to do the will of the people. And we have heard from some of my colleagues, some legislators, about the need to have compassion for those who have been convicted of second-degree murder. How do you respond to that?
Well, I ask them to show compassion to that six-year-old boy who lost his dad that day and who I have tried to explain what happened. I want them to show compassion for him, because when I hear about a compassionate release for someone who's elderly, I think, okay, so you want to show compassion for someone who's taken another person's life so that they have an opportunity for freedom, an opportunity to hold their loved ones, opportunities that are no longer available to me, to Ethan, to people who in our situation. You know, the only way we get to spend time with our loved one is in the cemetery, is it a gravestone. There was no compassion shown by the person who did this to Todd. There was no compassion shown to that six-year-old boy who lost his father. Where was the compassion there? So it's really hard for me to hear that word compassion associated with people who have taken someone's life. These aren't people who are convicted of stealing a pack of gum. These are people who took a life. That's serious.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court gave the legislature a mandate to create new sentencing guidelines, and it was 120 days. What happens now that 120-day deadline has passed?
That's a very good question, because quite frankly, nobody fully knows what this is going to look like. We don't have that same degree of detail here from our Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And so how this should be flowing, if it's going to mirror at all our prior experience, we're going to get Post-Conviction Relief Act petitions in York County of our 26 individuals serving life without parole for second-degree murder. One of them has already filed a petition. We know that we're going to be getting them from all of them, and then they will have the right to have counsel appointed to them. And the litigation will then be on what are they entitled to as a sentence. And that's where we really get into, we're not sure what the courts around this Commonwealth are going to do with their interpretation.
So you don't have hard guidelines for the resentencing of those individuals who the Lee decision is applicable to.
That's correct.
So 67 counties, potentially 67 different remedies for an individual who's committed a similar crime with similar circumstances.
Yeah, that would be correct.
So then what are the repercussions of having non-uniform sentencing standards in Pennsylvania, not just for those individuals who will be resentenced, but for those who have yet to be sentenced?
It means each county could essentially have its own sentencing standard based upon its own individual determinations of what is fair and just without any consideration of how it plays out going across a county line. And it shouldn't be so different that if you commit one type of crime in County A and commit the same crime in County B, that you have something that doesn't even resemble each other in the treatment. That is really a breakdown in what is an actual just result. It then is a matter of, hey, I just happened to pick the right or wrong county to commit this type of crime. And that is not how the discretion that exists within what a county can and should do, how that should be. That is too vast, too broad, and it creates a total vagueness in terms of how we operate.
Does that create a constitutional issue as well?
It very well could.
What is your recommendation for victims, families?
Keep speaking. Keep engaged. We're going to need your input. Some victims will choose to speak in public forums for advocacy. No victim should have to expect to carry that weight. If they choose to do so, we will help them. We'll help connect them with individuals. But keep speaking about your loved one in the process with us, because your voice is going to really matter when we go into court. Really is going to matter. Don't give up your voice. Don't give that up. I recommend that to all victims.
Well, thank you, District Attorney Tim Barker, for helping our listeners understand this important issue, and most importantly, thank you for your work to ensure that our communities are safe and that fairness exists for victims and their loved ones.
You never get over a loss like this, and you know, we feel it every day. And Ethan feels it every day, and especially when he reaches milestones, right? That's when he feels really acutely the loss of his father. But with that life sentence with no chance of parole, we were able to put that part of it aside and do we did the best we possibly could to live life. Me as a single mom, and again, you know, kudos to all the single moms out there. The issue I have is I was a single mom, not by choice. This is something that man who took Todd from us, that's the burden he gave me. It wasn't Todd. It was him. He chose this for me. And in terms of, you know, with Ethan, he dictated the fact that Ethan grew up without a father. And, you know, that kind of loss is something felt every day. And again, even though we do live with this pain every day, we're able to live life because that part of it, the part where he was sentenced, and he was sentenced to life with no parole, we were confident, I was confident, that meant that we can, you know, go on with the rest of our lives the best we could without Todd. I've lived now almost 59 years, so most of my life is in my rearview mirror, but my son is just starting his life. I don't I would not feel safe that the person who took his father from him won't do the same thing to him. And as a mom, I've always been protective of him, especially from that day that I knew I was his only parent. And I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do everything I possibly could to make sure that that person never sees the light of day.
This is about Todd.
Yes, and Ethan.
And Ethan, how would you like your husband to be remembered?
I want him to be remembered as a kind, hardworking, funny, but mostly hardworking and devoted father, because that's who he was. When he said goodbye to Ethan that morning, when he dropped him off to summer camp, neither he nor Ethan knew at the time that was the last hug, that was the last goodbye, the last I love you. Neither one of them knew that. And I want people to remember that that's the Todd that Ethan misses. It's the father, the devoted father, who in 6 short years delivered every nugget of information he possibly could to his son. And that he was a law-abiding, hardworking man who just followed the rules, and he became successful through his own hard work. And that's how I want them to remember him.
I think you have been blessed to have had such wonderful, wonderful memories. And I'm so incredibly sorry that he was taken from you and your son, and that we've not been able to come to a conclusion in this building that would protect you and your son and other people just like you. You're incredibly strong, you're incredibly brave, and I'm incredibly grateful that you were willing to share this incredibly impactful story of the wonderful man that you called your husband and Ethan's dad.
Thank you all for taking time out of your day to listen to this special edition of Kristen's Corner. If someone you love was a victim of second-degree murder, I encourage you to speak up. Let your legislators know exactly where you stand. And if you have any questions, please do not hesitate to visit my website at senatorkristen.com. This is Kristen Phillips Hill signing off, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.